I am Christine Sandy, Program Director of the Rural Assistance Center, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar, HIV in Rural America. We've worked collaboratively with the folks at HRSA to plan this webinar. However, due to the absence of either a fiscal year 2014 appropriation or a continuing resolution for the Department of Health and Human Services, our colleagues at HRSA won't be able to join us today, including one of our featured speakers, Dr. Deborah Parham Hobson. However, since this is really an issue that impacts the populations that HRSA serves, we thought it would be important to go ahead and hold the webinar as planned today. At the end of 2009, an estimated 1.1 million Americans ages 13 and older were living with human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, in the United States. Approximately 50,000 of them were living in rural areas. At the same time, 7.7% of new diagnoses of HIV and AIDS were in rural areas. While overall rates of people living with AIDS and HIV are lower in rural areas, people living with those conditions in rural areas face unique challenges due to barriers to diagnosis and service, including low rates of insurance in rural areas, transportation barriers, as well as stigma. Low population density and lower rates of prevalence can also make it difficult for rural communities to provide adequate services to people living with HIV and AIDS. In addition to the slides that will be covered during the webinar today, you can find the slides that Dr. Deborah Parham Hobson, who is the HRSA Senior Advisor on HIV and AIDS Policy, prepared for today. We thought it would be important that you have access to those slides about the federal strategy and programs related to HIV, even though we won't have a speaker covering those today. And we are delighted to have two real experts on HIV in rural America join us today. First, we will hear from Dr. Janice Probst regarding what the research tells us about HIV and AIDS in rural America. Dr. Probst is a professor in the Department of Health Services Policy and Management at the Arnold School of Public Health, the University of South Carolina, where she leads the federally funded South Carolina Rural Health Research Center. Dr. Probst received her undergraduate training at Duke University and her graduate training at Purdue University and the University of South Carolina. Dr. Probst has extensive experience in health services research, with an emphasis on rural and vulnerable populations. She has more than 90 papers in the peer-reviewed literature. Dr. Probst received the 2008 National Rural Health Association Outstanding Researcher Award for her work in rural minority health. In 2013, the University of South Carolina awarded her the Martin Luther King Jr. Social Justice Award for faculty. Our next presenter will be Dr. William Yarber, who will discuss HIV and AIDS prevention in rural communities. Dr. Yarber is the Senior Director of the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention at Indiana University, Bloomington, and Professor of Applied Health Sciences at IU. He is also a Senior Research Fellow at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. Dr. Yarber has authored or co-authored numerous scientific reports on sexual risk behavior and AIDS and STD prevention in professional journals and has received several federal and state grants to support his research and AIDS-STD prevention efforts. He is a member of the Kinsey Institute Condom Use Research Team, or CURT. For over a decade, with federal and institutional research support, CURT has investigated male condom use, particularly use errors and problems, and has developed behavioral interventions designed to improve correct and consistent condom use. At the request of the U.S. government, Dr. Yarber authored the country's first secondary school AIDS prevention education curriculum called AIDS, What Young People Should Know. Dr. Yarber is the lead author of Human Sexuality, Diversity in Contemporary America, a college human sexuality textbook used in over 300 colleges and universities nationwide. Dr. Yarber chaired the National Guidelines Task Force, which developed the Guidelines for Comprehensive Sexuality Education, Kindergarten through 12th grade, published by the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, and adapted in six countries worldwide. Dr. Yarber is past president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality and a past chair of the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States Board of Directors. He has been a consultant to the World Health Organization Global Program on AIDS, as well as sexuality-related organizations in Jamaica, Portugal, and Brazil. And with that, we're now ready to hear from our first presenter, Jan Probst. Jan?
I would like to thank you first for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of the prevalence work that we've done in finding out where HIV/AIDS is in the rural U.S., and of course acknowledge that nothing that any of us does, especially me, is a single-handed project. These are my co-investigators who helped us with this data collection, Adisha Lenners, who has now completed her PhD and is Dr. Lenners, Dr. Mehta Iyer, who is a PhD MD, and Dr. Sarah Glover. All of these have helped us with the reports and the information that I'm going to provide next. And since our first speaker, who could not be here but still said I should tackle the topic of what is HIV, I will attempt, as a non-clinician, non-biologist, to lead us off by, just in case we have any new folks to this conference, just briefly describing what HIV and AIDS are. HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus, which actually was discovered second, that AIDS was discovered first. It reduces something called CD4 lymphocyte cells. Do not ask me what they are, but they're very important because you need them to combat infection. And normal adults have between 500 and 1,000 of those cells in each cubic millimeter of their blood. When the HIV virus begins, it slowly drops those levels, and treatment is recommended somewhere in the 500 to 350 millimeter range. At any level, the person who has HIV is contagious, but in general, the contagion is greater the lower their CD count level. And how do you keep the CD4 count low? You keep people in treatment, but we'll go on to that. Okay, if the CD4 count gets very, very low, below 200, various immune deficiency diseases that once were rare can show up. As a very, very old researcher, I can remember in the 80s, people discussing the unusual occurrence of a disease that used to be rare called Kaposi's sarcoma, a particular type of skin cancer. So there are certain diagnoses, like Kaposi's sarcoma, or a CD4 count below 200 is what we consider to be acquired immune deficiency syndrome. We have these two names as a heritage of the past. The acquired immune deficiency syndrome was labeled. There's a syndrome. We don't know what's causing it. And only after it had been studied for a number of years was the contributing virus, HIV, finally identified, which is why there are still two confusing names for one basic condition. The person is HIV positive if they are living with HIV or AIDS. Okay. As was noted, there's approximately, I think my number is a tad higher than Christine's, about 1.2 million persons, and estimates are not precise, living with HIV/AIDS in the U.S. And what I'd like to talk about today is to point out that this disease disproportionately affects certain populations. Those populations include minorities, non-white Americans, women, persons living in the South, and that last category, rural. And I'm going to raise that controversial point that could AIDS, HIV positivity, evolve into a rural disease? Maybe not based on numbers, but based on the percent of the population that has it. So what I'm going to talk about today is research from the South Carolina Rural Health Research Center on the prevalence of HIV positivity in rural America and service availability in rural America. And it's in the potential mismatch between those two that I think we have the possibility for a very undesirable growth in prevalence. Okay, prevalence, okay, I'm a scientist, so I have to say where I got my data. Part of what I will talk about today was retrieved by us from websites all across the U.S. We went to every Department of Health, tried to ascertain if they published HIV prevalence data, how many, you know, what percent of the population has prevalence, has HIV at the county level. At that time, we were able to identify 28 states and 2,000 counties that had that data. And we are, so the first information I'll present is from our study, which if you're interested in the full report is available at our website, which is shown there. Since that time, two additional sources of data have become available. The 2013 Robert Wood Johnson County Rankings Projects database has 2009 data that was provided to that project by CDC's National Center for HIV/AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. The CDC also provided this organization, using 2010 data, provided this information to a group called AIDSview, and it's aidsview.org, so if you're interested in this data, you can go there. I give all this detail about where we get the data in case there's anyone listening at the state or county level who wants to access one of these data sources for helping in their own planning. Limitations to the data, as noted on our report, we could only find 28 states. CDC suppresses data for any county with fewer than 20 cases. So since counties with small numbers of persons are more likely to be rural counties, data suppression affects rural more than it affects urban counties in the U.S. Okay, so with that big introduction, details where you can look for further information, what did we find out about what are the prevalence rates for HIV positivity in rural? Big picture, was giving you the ending before we get to the beginning. Yes, HIV is present in rural America. It tracks closely with poverty and with rural minority race ethnicity, and these rates are growing. I've got some scary clippies. Okay, this is from our first report, and hopefully people can see my little mouse as it wanders across this. When we first did this, but using 2008 data, we were able to get information down to the county level on the 28 states you'll see here. And if you look at your own state, you'll notice that this Q4, the dark color, is not limited to urban counties. It's in rural counties in Northern California, rural counties as well as urban counties in Washington, rural counties throughout the Southwest, throughout the Southeast. One of the things that we picked up on very quickly was that HIV, if you look at what quartile does a county fit in, is not limited to the cities. Cities may have the big numbers because more people live there, but when you look at the rate, the proportion of the population affected, rural America is sadly keeping up. Now, specifically for this presentation, we did two additional analyses with the newer data that we were able to find. This is HIV prevalence in 2009, and at this point, we were able to look at 43 states. And you'll see that we've done our colors a little differently. We have rural high, which is a really dark red, rural low, which is a sort of pink, and then urban high, which is dark green, and urban low, which is light green. And gosh darn, those same counties are lighting up. But we're also able to see something interesting, which is that, you know, we have rural counties, and it's much clearer when you've got them in two different colors, that have high prevalence, that are located in really, really rural areas. Like this little one that I'm circling right now is some sort of, is in Oklahoma, which I don't think most people consider terribly urban, and certainly not that part of it. So, yes, we have rates above the national median in the big cities in California, in the big urban areas of New York and New Jersey, but we also have them in rural areas. Notice I'm sort of circling upstate New York here. If anybody is from that area, some of those counties are frontier in their population density, but they are keeping up with the bigs when it comes to HIV. Here we have pockets in Appalachia. Here we have the southern rural counties of the entire Southeast. All these dark red counties are rural, but they have HIV positivity rates above the national average. And anecdotally, since we did not do a subsequent detailed analysis for this, I can say things like this pattern of counties, which continues into 2010. When you find an isolated rural county, like this one up in Washington State, American Indian Reservation. When you look at these guys in the rural South, high minority populations here are principally African American. When you look at some of the rural counties here, you have a mixture of African American and Hispanic populations. Where you have the combination of poverty plus minority status plus rural, you've got those high rates. To me, that sort of creates a perfect storm. This is where we need to intervene. Our next speaker is going to tell us how to do this. One of the things that I find a little bit alarming is that when I was preparing these maps, I asked my graduate student to cut me down just some specific states, and all of a sudden and she had them in two colors, but I let that gray stay so I could see them. And all of a sudden noticed when I looked at the state level, pop, look at that. Here's one that was below the median in 2009, but it's gone, it's a rural county, and it's jumped above the median. And it isn't the only rural county changing. Here's a little rural county, this is Kansas, this is Oklahoma. Here's a little rural county down in Oklahoma that didn't used to show up, and now it does show up. And here's another little rural county that didn't used to show up, and now it does. I realize I'm extrapolating, and I should do this for the whole U.S. in a big scientific analysis, but look at what's happening. To me, I see rural areas becoming darker that used to be below the reporting level that would get shown. And it's not always, this one's supposed to end at the red one. We've got lots of these. There's another white one going to a pink one. And another pink one going to a red one. These are rural counties becoming more acute. And in only one case do we have a rural county that used to be above the median for prevalence that's going the other way. Like I say, these are tiny harbingers, but this is something I worry about. Is the rate of HIV prevalence in rural America growing faster than in urban America? And is it, by any chance, related to the absence of services in these areas? This is what leads me to worry that we are going to go in a direction of rural pockets of contagion that we never eliminate. Okay. This is from our 2008 study. We looked at the rural prevalence and urban prevalence of HIV, and we compared rural prevalence, which is the sort of Garnet line, to the prevalence across the whole state, which is the gray line. And in 2008, with the data that we had, we found one state, unfortunately South Carolina, my home state, in which the rural prevalence, the rate at which people have HIV is higher than in our cities or therefore in the rest of our state. We went and redid that sort of analysis. We only studied, this is in the 2010 data, we only studied the states for which we had a report for every single county on the AIDSVU data, and another one of those pings. It used to be just South Carolina was rural greater than urban. Now we've got Florida, which has HIV prevalence of rural in rural counties that is greater than the HIV prevalence in urban counties. Now remember, this is not the absolute number of people. If you go to a big place like Miami, you're going to get a bigger number of people. But the proportion of the population that has this disease is greater in Florida. In Florida, is greater than in rural counties than in urban. And one of my concerns is that this will continue. In North Carolina, the rates are close. In Massachusetts, they're close. In New York, maybe not so close. But, you know, these differences that we are seeing between rural and urban, I do not believe are as great as they might once have been. I think that we are evening out. That's a kind of rural parity that I don't want, the HIV prevalence rates. And I'm very concerned that the trend, that if we come back and do this with 2013 data, there's going to be five states in which rural is greater than urban. Circle back. Okay, so why might this be happening? And I will be talking just about one particular program, and I think our next speaker will be talking in much greater detail. Okay, HIV, back in the 80s, and I was in public health in the 80s, was a death sentence. I mean, what part of the stigma associated with the disease was both the populations in which it first took a foothold and also that you were going to die and it was contagious and you were going to kill everybody. But now it has become, with the introduction of antiretroviral therapy, a chronic disorder. But those antiretroviral meds are not inexpensive. So you have to have good health care just to pay for the meds, not to mention the cost of your doctor visits and so on. If you are not sufficiently wealthy, and a lot of persons living with HIV or AIDS are not, you can get care through the Ryan White program. Unfortunately, our speaker on the Ryan White program was not here, and I have one slide, but we'll talk about it. Nearly half of people get care through Ryan White. So for our purposes, in terms of ascertaining who's in treatment and who isn't, we are looking at the location of Ryan White programs. It covers nearly half of the people. It's the funding that it provides for care is significant, $2.1 billion. One of my concerns is where that funding goes, especially since, given where the epidemic started, 30% of Ryan White funding is legislatively directed to urban, is automatically directed to urban areas. I do not know whether that is legislation or regulation. So I don't have anybody looking at me to ask questions. This is a limitation. We do not have information on people who may be getting their HIV care from private providers. I know that here in South Carolina there are clinics that actually have developed an infectious disease specialty in HIV for insured populations. These may be present in other places. I have no information on the VA. So we're just looking at where, if you go and ask, gee, I have HIV, I'm moving into this community, where is my provider? That's what we did. We mapped all of the Ryan White providers that were present on the Health Resources and Services Administration HIV AIDS Bureau website. This is where they are. Okay, there we go. And as you can see, they're spread all over the place. And here we have, just to go through the categories, the really darkest category is an urban county with a Ryan White provider. The sort of reddish one is a rural county with a Ryan White provider. And as you can see, they're fairly densely concentrated. There's a lot of them in the really high need areas. And actually in the southeast, you'll notice that there are a fair number of red rural counties that light up. Certainly the remarkable HIV prevalence in the rural south has not gone totally unnoticed by local providers. But you know what? We still have a lot of rural counties that have nothing. You might say, well, there's not a lot of people in Nevada. Well, there aren't, but they can still get sick. One thing I should have mentioned about treatment keeps your viral loads down, which makes you less contagious. But people here in South Carolina, we have found that 40 to 50% of people do not stay in care, meaning they do not show up at their provider and get their viral load test once a year. So the fact that people drift in and out of care is a significant problem for controlling the infection and for educating those people about what they should do. As we all know, we're all bad at taking our doctor's orders, but it is at least helpful if we've heard them now and then. If you don't go visit your provider at all, you won't. This map is available in our report, which is available on our website. Why am I concerned? If you live in an urban area, only about 14%, across the U.S., 14% of persons in 28 states live in a county with no provider. That's only 11% of people who live in an urban county don't have a provider in their own county. So in other words, virtually all urban counties have an HIV provider, have a Ryan White provider who can help low-income persons with HIV get care. 78% of the rural counties we studied in 28 states did not have a provider. Or in other words, not having a provider is sort of the mode. It's what you expect. If you're rural, you're going to have to leave your county most of the time. Now, of course, more urban people are traveling than rural people because more people live in urban. But I think if I were asked to guess how many people in rural America, if you went from 28 states to all 50, have to leave their county to get care, I'd say that's about 50,000 people, like extrapolating up to the whole U.S. So I can hear everybody saying, so big deal, they have to drive a little bit. Well, maybe they have to drive a little bit. One of the concerns that I have is that in some cases, it's not a small distance. This is that little red zone from 2010 data in Kansas. I went and found a town in that tiny county from Norton, Kansas to Wichita. It's 268 miles. Ka-ching. And then in this little county, I found a tiny city here, Guymon, I guess that's how they say it, Oklahoma. To go from Guymon to the nearest HIV/AIDS provider is 263 miles. So the distances that you have to drive to get from places that are in, if you're HIV positive and live in these great stretches with no provider in them, can be significant enough that they may be a deterrent. Even though we say rural people drive further, they don't do, you know, your basic 500-600 mile round trips every day. So that may, in fact, be a deterrent to care. So what do I conclude from all of this? One is that we know that HIV is present in rural. We are concerned that it may be growing in rural at an inappropriate rate, and there simply aren't the providers there. If you just look at Ryan White, there's not the providers there that possibly should be. And we need a little bit more detailed research to find out what is it. Does the distance that you live from your provider affect the all-important remaining in care status and thus your health outcomes? Another area in which our research may be deficient and maybe we're missing something is that maybe there are other providers who are giving care. If there are, the one point that we would like to note is that this is a complex condition. HIV is not like treating the common cold, and it's not even like treating diabetes, where providers are likely to encounter enough of it that they will realize that they need to get continuing ed credits in. We may need to expand the resources that we have availability, as the VA does, to use telemedicine and teleeducation to see how we can improve HIV care and this HIV retention in care in rural areas. My concern is that if we do not do something to improve the availability of care and resources, we may have a rural HIV epidemic that we don't control and that will really come back to bite us in 10 years. And at this point, I'd like to thank the Rural Assistance Center for giving me this opportunity and turn it over to our next speaker, who I'm sure will be far more knowledgeable about the details of HIV.
Okay. Jan, this is Christine. Before we get to Dr. Yarber, I would just note that a couple of people have written in and wanting to clarify that the new national treatment guidelines for treating HIV patients recommend that antiretroviral treatment occur for every patient with HIV, regardless of CD4 count.
Okay, I apologize. I did get that from the CDC, but, you know, what with the shutdown, I suspect they're not updating websites.
So, two different people wrote in with that. So,
thank you. Thank you, everyone, for sharing that, because that makes the availability of a Ryan White provider even more important.
Right. And there's also someone who's interested in the Alaska data and saying that it doesn't look accurate. Could that person contact you directly, Jan?
Oh, I would be delighted. And I'll share what we have and they can tell us what's wrong.
Great. So do you have your
right. If I were clever, I would put my my email address. It's just jprobst, J-P-R-O-B-S-T, at SC for South Carolina, .edu. jprobst@sc.edu. And if you just Google our website or my name, you'll find me.
Okay. Great. With that, we'll turn it over to Dr. Bill Yarber.
Bill Yarber. I'm the Senior Director of the Rural Center for AIDS STD Prevention at Indiana University. We will be celebrating actually our 20th anniversary of existence this coming spring. And you can see on this website that if you need to contact me, the email is aids@indiana.edu, and the RCAP is the acronym that we use, is listed there on the web page, or also on the screen also. But those are the ways that you can contact me. This happens to be our logo. We have individuals say, oh, yeah, you're the organization that has the candle. And so we thought that was a kind of a logo that would represent rural areas, but shining a light on things that we need to do for prevention. I'm going to talk about four different things briefly today. It's hard to obviously cover every aspect of prevention programming relative to education and resources just in this brief time. But I'm going to talk some about the challenges of HIV-STD prevention and management in rural America. Briefly about some of the places for prevention programming, some ideas about adapting intervention, and then some of the opportunities we have for in the future. One trait of rural America is that it's there's a lot of disparities among populations in rural America. But certainly, oftentimes, rural America is much different than urban. And so, therefore, the challenges, I would say, for HIV prevention in rural communities are quite unique. And as you can see on this quote here, this illustrates one of the most significant barriers and challenges in rural America relative to sexually transmitted infections, HIV included, as well as information about sexuality. And you can read that quote as I am talking here. What I think is really significant, of course, is the power of the first sentence. The fear of stigma leads to silence, and when it comes to fighting AIDS, silence is death. And when you look in rural America, the stigma, I would say, goes hand in hand with this problem of anonymity. And that may be a little bit different than it would be in rural communities, but in urban areas. In rural communities, the threat of being noticed, the threat of being identified relative to maybe, for example, buying condoms or treatment for substance abuse or even treatment for HIV and diagnosis is so powerful in many communities that it hinders individuals from protecting themselves from HIV. And as you go along with stigma, there's other aspects of the rural environment that make it difficult. There are challenges for our efforts to minimize the risk of HIV and STD in rural communities, and that would be racism and other forms of discrimination that increase pressure on individuals in rural communities that increase pressure for them to engage in risky behaviors underground. And there are other types of factors that do contribute. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of those. One aspect of rural America is the fact that it's not homogeneous, that there are many cultural differences, there's many different populations. This presents, I think, additional HIV prevention treatment challenges that I'm going to talk about, and educational challenges that I'll talk about pretty soon. But this idea, and I guess this is a common phrase that we've all heard, one size fits all for HIV and STD prevention efforts is clearly not realistic in a multicultural rural America. Despite that, there are some commonalities, and I just want to name a couple of those commonalities in rural America. And one would be a distrust of government and the healthcare system. And the other one is the fact that there's a lot of value placed on rural control. There's a lot of difference in structural disparity that I think influences HIV and STD prevention in rural communities. The structural disparity may be a reflection of poverty. It may be a reflection of limited economic opportunity. But we know in many rural communities there are fewer job opportunities. There's smaller tax base. There's lack of adequately trained health care providers. Public transportation, that's already been mentioned, is a major issue. And a lot of rural communities, actually most, have inadequate infrastructures for mobilizing and leveraging resources. And so this economic context of the rural community presents an enormous challenge. And as those who are in rural areas understand and know, that there's extremely limited federal funding specifically for HIV, STD prevention in rural America. So what I'm going to be talking about, the material I'm going to be presenting briefly in these next few minutes, actually are based from a prevention guide that the RCAP developed called Tearing Down Defenses, HIV STD Prevention Rural America. It was developed by a network of individuals, rural individuals and national organizations. And this, there's a PDF of that on our website, so you can get the entire copy on our website. One of the major aspects of challenge, I think, is in rural communities is to get adequate information to the individuals, particularly those at risk. I mean, certainly we know that medical advances are significant, and we've seen that in certainly in HIV and AIDS treatment. But as an educator, I think one of the ultimate solutions to HIV is this, beyond medical advances, it's providing adequate information and prevention services. And not only preventing new infection depends on medicine, but as we know, it depends on individuals practicing safe sexual and drug abuse behaviors. And as the epidemic has evolved, we have found that strategies for HIV prevention, educational programs, most of those have been developed and researched for urban areas. And there's some issues with that I'll be talking about in a few minutes. But if, overall, if you look at a lot of the HIV education in rural communities, most often they're poorly planned, inadequately implemented. Rarely there's an evaluation of these programs. But I think, though, education can be a particularly strong prevention strategies, important strategy for rural areas, particularly because of the fact of limited or even no resources designated for medical treatment and prevention. And one thing about rural communities is that many of them have really a very more of a homogeneous and strong value system, and also a lot of health needs that may compete with health concerns in that community. And so, therefore, we would believe that these educational efforts have to be tailored to specific type of audience, and that these tailored interventions can be based on urban areas, but they need to be based on programs in urban from urban areas, but they need to be adapted to tailored, particularly in the rural America. So you can see this one particular slide, a quote here that really, I think, emphasizes the value of a knowledgeable population in a rural community. So I want to briefly talk about four venues here that could be really important in HIV and prevention in rural communities. And of course, the thing about schools is that schools reach nearly, not all, maybe 95% of all youth. And so it's a great opportunity, but also it's an obligation that many people think to provide young people with knowledge and skills to avoid STIs and HIV. Most states in the United States mandate schools teaching about HIV. Over 90% of the adults in the United States believe that schools should provide sexuality education. But anyone who's been involved in this area and tried to work in schools, of course, realizes that there's controversies about the content. Typically, the controversy is that should we educate about abstinence only until marriage, or should we provide a more comprehensive approach? And that kind of challenge continues in our culture, and it continues in rural communities, and one that is a challenge to provide young people an adequate information that they can protect themselves. And it may even go on to a philosophical perspective about this. Do young people have a right to have the knowledge to protect their health? The type of knowledge, of course, is debated in our country. But there are a lot of programs that have been research showing to effectively decrease sexual risk behavior. Many of those are age-appropriate, they're medically accurate, they're presented by an instructor who's not judgmental, and there are organizations that can give information about that. You can check their websites for Advocates for Youth, the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, compendiums from CDC, ETR Associates, and CECAS. But Doug Kirby has reviewed and developed curricula and has presented information about which of the traits are effective in preventing HIV through school curriculum. He's found that those curricula that are most effective are those that emphasize that are theory-based, that provide safer skills training, provide practice of new skills, use formative research, target and tailor messages to specific audiences, and have multiple sessions, among other kinds of traits. But the research of this has found that soundly developed educational programs in school settings have been effective in delaying the initiation of sex, have improved refusal skills, and increased condom use. Those are the ones that have been found effective. Another venue, of course, is the community. We know that many rural communities lack funding resources, but yet, guess what? They may be rich in human resources. Many of those are volunteers, and volunteers can do a lot. But rarely can they be held responsible as the sole responsibility for prevention. As we know, state and local health departments can certainly be valuable and need to be the anchor for this. But if you look from community to community, the needs may be different. Some communities may have a particular problem with those imprisoned in correctional facilities. Some may have particular problems with men who have sex with men, particularly African-American men in the Deep South. Migrant workers, victims of partner violence, those who use methamphetamine drug users. So a challenge in rural communities is the fact that that there's different populations, and a particular challenge is, of course, adapting any particular urban intervention to the rural communities. Unfortunately, we know that many local health departments are understaffed and many are underfunded. Another venue for HIV-STD prevention is the faith community. David Satcher, MD, the 16th U.S. Surgeon General, said the church has been silent too long about sexuality. So there are several faith-based organizations that have good programs in HIV and STD prevention. And health care providers, even though they may be medically trained to diagnose and treat HIV, although that's the challenge in rural communities to have specialists, we need, I think, further emphasis and further training on the commitment and ability to ask patients about their risk behaviors. And physicians and medical personnel in rural communities may be hesitant to do that because these individuals may be their neighbors. They may be their friends, and it's a very difficult and sensitive topic to approach. In this textbook that I mentioned, this guide, Tearing Down Fences, there's one particular chapter that I think could be very valuable to people. In this particular chapter called Behavioral Interventions That May Work, again, that they may work, that he's been shown to have evidence in urban areas, but maybe not in rural areas. But it does give examples of current programs that decrease unprotected sex between male and male sex, unprotected and for injecting drug users, programs tailored to women, programs tailored to youth, programs tailored to ethnic and racial minorities. And here are some of the important tenets in adapting behavioral intervention that most of those show empirical evidence in the urban area, but don't have that evidence in in urban areas, but doesn't have it in rural areas. That doesn't mean that we can't adapt those, and it does not mean that they may not be effective. But there are certain principles that you can see here listed that can be, that I think are actually necessary for adapting of these interventions to rural communities. So there are opportunities, and I think if we look ahead here, one of the traits of rural America is that sometimes there's a false sense of security. There's a low annual HIV incidence in many rural communities. As I've already said, there's a lot of denial. There can be stigma. There can be homophobia. And so a lot of this denial and complacency, I think it makes it really difficult for them to have adequate prevention programs. Not only do we mean educational programs, but ongoing surveillance, increased public awareness, attention to other STDs that may be a way of educating about HIV. So one challenge is this real HIV complacency. And so that calls attention, I think, to focus on HIV risk. And you can do that one by talking about other STDs like chlamydia, syphilis, hepatitis B, and other STDs. Another opportunity is to reduce stigma. And some people in rural communities through our work have said we need to destigmatize HIV in rural America. And without that, the testing, the risk reduction, and the prevention programs is going to be really difficult because of the fear of discrimination and the fear of violence. But removing stigma can also open the door to greater social support, and that's very, very important, particularly in the rural community. That means we have to change attitudes toward people who are often marginalized in our culture. It's very, very difficult to do that, but it's a very, very important goal. Another challenge is to develop effective rural HIV STD prevention intervention. We need to identify rural specific strategies, and this, the tearing down the fences actually identifies some of those. And we can, at least four or five populations need to be the focus of this. Men who have sex with men, black men and women residing particularly in the deep rural south, marginalized lower economic communities, injected and drug users, migrant workers, and new immigrants. We need to take advantage of broad social and scientific advances. And this is technology, telemedicine, internet, mobile phones, text messaging, long-distance services, chat room. All these can provide a way to reach rural communities. And, of course, the fact that rural communities do have limited resources, minimal funding options, and a difficult time initiating rapid change, we need to take advantage of what we got. And that's volunteers, that's partnerships. And these things, I think, collaborations can be really valuable for rural communities. So it's been said, of course, that evidence does demonstrate that we're not powerless. And, of course, that we can do more. The challenge is to increase increase massively the political will, resources, systems, and social commitment. But unfortunately, as a rural health provider has told us, is that the needs are immense and all-encompassing, and yet rural areas oftentimes don't have the solution, the magic capacity to do that. Indeed, I don't think that there's any simple solutions that will magically end rural HIV. There are opportunities that make a difference, but there are unique challenges and limited resources in rural America. And that means that we need to know the community, we need to assess what the risk is, we need to understand the context. And now I think is the time to come together and put all that together. And so going back to the document from RCAP, Tearing Down the Fences, I think now's the time to come together to tear down the fences that divide communities, tear down the fences that isolate individuals, tear down the fences that prevent collaboration, allow HIV funding to be increased to rural communities, and as these fences collapse, hopefully new ideas and partnerships will arise to strengthen HIV prevention in rural America. In the textbook, I'd like to read, in concluding, this quote. Much like rural America itself, the road to effective HIV STD prevention and control may be unpaved and winding, yet the moral obligation to develop and smooth this road is clearly evident. The challenges are inherently difficult, and the available research and financial support are modest at best. Innovative, collaborative responses and solutions are required to contain and reduce HIV and other STDs in rural communities. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Yarber. And that concludes the presentations for today's webinar. And now we can go in to the question and answer period. We have just a few minutes left. So I'll just start and ask a few, and we'll see how many we get through. Let's see. The question is, in Wisconsin, there simply are not enough HIV providers to have one in each of our 72 counties. We seem to be succeeding with rural clients with our primary care support network, where specialists in HIV care interact frequently as expert consultants and intensive medical case managers with clients and their primary care providers by phone, by visits at clinic, home, or community, and with local education efforts related to specific patients and their circumstances, such as training local obstetric staff on the special needs of a birthing mother with HIV, and by case studies done via conference sessions. Have either of the speakers know of other circumstances like that, or have direct knowledge of those sorts of programs?
I do not, and I want to encourage the Wisconsin folks to present their stuff at the next Rural Health Association meeting, because I think we need to get more rural examples out there.
Yeah, I concur about that recommendation. I mean, that's one of the most important things, I think, is for us to share programs that work or programs that bring people together that fill the void of lack of resources. And so I hope it can be presented.
Exactly.
And certainly, if you have information, we'd be glad to post that on our website.
Just noticing, Wisconsin's actually better at having Ryan White providers than other counties and other states in the Midwest. But keep up the good work. On Wisconsin.
Okay. And on that note, another question was asking you to define again, what is a Ryan White medical provider?
Oh, gosh. A Ryan White, okay, the way we defined it was basically going to, and I'm trying to go there right now, hoping this is not down. We went to the HIV/AIDS Bureau's website, Ryan White. Well, there's a whole bunch of Ryan White things. Let me see if I can find HIV. Okay, the HIV AIDS Bureau within HRSA. Oh, Lord, just hopefully it has a thing, find HIV AIDS medical care. And basically you can go there. You can search by address and search by state or county. And we went, and basically there's also a backdoor you can use to get the list of all HIV, Ryan White HIV providers. For people who, if there's someone listening who wants to find that out for their own area, you can search by state or by county. It's findhivcare.hrsa.gov, and then there's like a little backslash that you're actually into the search window. But if you go to the HIV AIDS Bureau within HRSA, they make it real easy to find these. Now, I'm going to go to Wisconsin. But you can't see my screen because it's not your screen. But if I click Wisconsin and search, see what happens. Please be good. Please be good to me. It's saying the dreaded loading content. Please wait. But I'm hoping it's going to give me a nice little map of Wisconsin because it says that's one of the options. Oh, never mind. It didn't find anything. I guess I didn't have my search. Never mind, but I recommend that people who don't do this live go find something.
Great. Thanks. Another question is the definition of men who have sex with men and interplay with new HIV epidemics a problematic issue? In other words, indigenous and African-American populations do not subscribe to MSM nor queer or gay labels. And this is more of an issue with youth than adults. Is that a problem for data collection and evidence-based practices? And if so, what can we do?
I'm going to defer that one to Dr. Yarber, who's much better.
I'm an epidemiologist, but I think that's important question, intriguing question. I mean, throughout the epidemic, there's been some evolution by the federal government of various groups, from homosexual to men who have sex with men, but yet that's a broad sweeping term. But you're exactly right that there are populations that that doesn't fit their cultural.
And certainly here in the black community in the South, I'm not even going to try to repeat the slang because I'm sure I'll screw it up and become a total object of ridicule. But yes, they do not define themselves as homosexuality. There are keywords for the behavior which may occur in addition to regular heterosexual sex. So they do not define themselves by that one behavior as being homosexual. So that, and that is an issue. I think we don't have anyone here who is, unless one of our listeners is a member of a health department where this information is actually taken down. We don't know if we're recording it accurately, therefore we don't know if the conclusions we draw are right. And there you go.
All right. Well, it looks like we're about at the end of our time, and so I think we'll wrap it up for today. On behalf of the Rural Assistance Center, I'd like to sincerely thank our speakers for the great information and insights that you've shared with us today.